far from over today on the world. I'm Marco Werman. Hurricane Maria is long gone, but for Puerto Rico, there are tough times still ahead.
I don't think there's a block that doesn't have at least a power line, at least one roof on the sidewalk.
Also, the PBS television series on the Vietnam War brings back some vivid memories.
You know, I had an uncle who went into the Vietnam War, you know, actually took a bullet in his canteen, thought he had been hit and wasn't going to come back. But it turned out that the bullet lodged on the inner wall of the canteen, so what he was feeling running down his side was water.
Plus, how a singer in the former Yugoslavia became a mariachi star.
He didn't speak Spanish at all. So he started to imitate the sounds of the music and the sounds of the lyrics.
The stories ahead on the world. I'm Marco Werman, and you're tuned to The World. Thank you for being with us. There are about 3.5 million people on the island of Puerto Rico. They're American citizens. Their island is a U.S. territory. But today, many Puerto Ricans are wondering if any of that matters. Two massive back-to-back storms with serious devastation coming from Hurricane Maria last week have thrown the island into economic, not to mention emotional, crisis. The Trump administration says it will continue to do everything it can to provide assistance. Many Puerto Ricans say, though, that that assistance isn't coming fast enough. Frances Robles is with the New York Times and is in San Juan. She's been speaking with people all across the island.
The emergency manager of the town of Arecibo started to cry. And when he cried was when he talked about the moment that he finally got through to his family on the phone. And so here's a guy who's in charge of bringing water and food and services to thousands of people. And he had tears in his eyes thinking of the second that he finally got to tell his brother that he's okay.
Wow.
And I wondered, I myself am Puerto Rican, and so I knew exactly what he was going through. And I wondered whether everybody in the United States understood the anguish. You know, you have so many people from Puerto Rico who have moved to Orlando, to New York, in the past 2 or 3 years, their hearts are here and their families are here.
The bottom line is that there seems to be no part of the island of Puerto Rico that is a safe haven at this point. Everything has been affected. Is that accurate?
It's been pretty remarkable in that sense. I mean, you can go, like right now I'm looking out my window and I see plenty of buildings that are still standing and everything looks generally okay. But if you start driving, I don't think there's a block that doesn't have at least a power line, at least a tree, at least one roof on the sidewalk. And I visited the northwest of the country on Friday. I visited the southeast yesterday. And you're seeing the same thing everywhere. It's just a mess.
So from towns to agricultural fields, is it fair to say that everything is pretty much crippled right now?
Crippled mostly because of the blackout and the lack of water. I don't want people to be left with the impression that all of Puerto Rico has been flattened. You know, I'm not looking at a pile of rubble. I'm not looking at sticks. But the ability to move forward is very difficult. I mean, I met a dairy farmer yesterday who said he's throwing away 4,000 liters of milk a day. And it's not that there's anything wrong with the milk. It's that the trucks don't arrive. It's because the stores aren't open. It's because there's no gasoline. So there's this long chain of events that's just paralyzing the entire island.
And how much is the fact that there's no electricity, therefore no refrigeration? How big a problem is that?
It's a huge problem. A lot of people do have generators, but they're running out of gas. The lines for the gasoline are really staggering. Yesterday, I did start seeing some stores open, and the lines were unbelievable. I think people did stock up somewhat prior to the storm. So, you know what, today's Monday, Wednesday will be a week. You know, we're approaching the point where people are going to have run out of the food that they had purchased prior to the storm.
Do you think we're looking at a humanitarian, some serious problems within the week?
I went to Arecibo on Saturday, and there was definitely the start of what looked like a humanitarian crisis, particularly for the people who had not gone to the shelters. They were just at the end of their ropes. They were literally breaking into stores that were covered in mud, and they were wiping off the mud and trying to determine what could be salvaged. So, for example, potato chips, you know, if you wipe off the bag, you can still give a kid a bag of potato chips. And that's what people were doing to eat. And they had run out of water. The emergency manager told me that he had one truck of water and he needed 10. And so multiply that by cities all around the islands, and then add that to the fact that some of the streets are still blocked.
So I think it was in your story in the Times, Francis, pretty much wherever you go, people want to know if you're FEMA. FEMA is there, right, on the island.
I know that they're here. I cannot say that I have seen them. I mean, the one thing that happens while you're here, because the communication system is so poor, is you really only know what's right in front of you. Okay, so I did go to the Northwest. I did go to the Southeast. I have been in San Juan, and I have not seen FEMA except in the hotel where they were based. And that's definitely what happens. Everywhere someone sees you and they see you with your notebook, they're like, oh, are you FEMA? Are you here to take pictures of and help me out? There is a real expectation here that checks are going to be coming to restore people. And I don't know the answer to that, if that is coming, in fact.
I mean, I have seen reports that FEMA has kind of dispatched each of the 28 task forces that they have around the U.S. to disaster zones, which is something that is pretty rare for FEMA. So do you have the sense that perhaps they're overstretched?
I can't fathom how FEMA or any other agency would be able to pull off Harvey, Irma, Puerto Rico, to the extent that people are expecting help. I just don't see how anybody would be able to pull that off. I just came from the Florida Keys. I can tell you, I still don't have power in my house. And how many weeks ago was that storm? 2 weeks ago?
Yeah.
So God bless them. God bless the people that are out there trying to get help to all these folks.
What is the latest with the Guajataca Dam in the northwest corner of the island? Because it was on the verge of failing and some 70,000 people had to be evacuated. What's the latest from there?
I don't know that the 70,000 figure was ever accurate.
Okay.
If you read carefully between the lines of what the governor had actually announced, he said 70,000 people could be affected. And so when I interviewed the emergency manager, he said they could be affected in the sense that that's their drinking water. And so for sure, we don't want this to rupture. But in actuality, it was probably around 500 to 1,000 people who were evacuated. And it's definitely a very, very serious situation for those people. But the majority of the homes that are around that dam are at a pretty significant height away from the dam, and they feel safe.
It was on the verge of failing, and then I saw that with cell phone towers down and electric down, residents were not getting the alert that they had to evacuate. How did they find out that the dam was going possibly to collapse?
Well, it's funny. I interviewed this lady at a shelter. She told me, so now remember that the storm was on Wednesday.
Right.
On Thursday, she heard a rumbling, crashing sound, and it was the sound of concrete crashing to the ground from the dam. And so she did not evacuate for the storm. She evacuated the next day. She goes to a church. She stays there for a day, and then, you know, she kind of thinks to herself, what am I going to do, you know, live in this church? So she went back home on Friday, and then, you know, not 3 or 4 hours after returning to her house, cars started going by with loudspeakers announcing that the dam was collapsing and that she had to make a run for it. And so luckily for her, she had actually already packed a few things. But most people said they had about 10 minutes to collect their things and go.
When the cell phone doesn't work, you have to go to a traditional broadcast, the old bullhorn.
Oh, I went to an area called Planahan on Saturday, and they were going door to door telling people, get out. And some people didn't want to. And they were there. There was the emergency manager guy with his life preserver on. It was actually kind of funny because he's like, oh, no, it's all exaggerated. It's not so bad. But he was wearing a life jacket. I was like, he's got a life jacket on. I don't have one on. So maybe this isn't the safest spot for us to be. It's definitely not a good situation.
Francis Robles with the New York Times in San Juan, thank you, and thanks for your reporting.
Thank you for having me.
Also on our agenda today, Colin Kaepernick and how Take a Knee has gone global. President Trump had plenty to say about it this weekend, some of it unsayable on the radio. We'll take a look at how people outside the U.S. are viewing it all coming up in a few minutes. But first, let's focus on another comment from the president, something he said at the United Nations last week. Trump called on Iran to free all Americans and citizens of other nations who are being detained there. That was an encouraging note for one woman in Princeton, New Jersey. Reporter Ibi Caputo has her story.
Huachu has not seen her husband, Xiu Wang, since April 2016. That's when Wang left for Iran to do research for his dissertation. Wang is 36 and a PhD candidate at Princeton studying Eurasian history. On the day before he was scheduled to return home, authorities in Tehran asked him to turn over his laptop and passport. He was interrogated, but allowed to move freely. 3 weeks later, Wang called and told Chu he'd been ordered to leave Iran immediately.
He said, I will purchase ticket now and I will call you back when I got to the airport. So I waited for about 3 hours or so. I didn't receive his call, so I sent a text message and checking if he's okay, but that text message went unanswered.
Administrators at Princeton hired an Iranian lawyer who confirmed that Wang was being detained in Iran's Evin prison. Chu said she became obsessed with Google Earth. She would zoom in on the prison as if she could find him behind the walls. 18 days passed before Chu heard from her husband again. He told her he had been in solitary confinement. He's now allowed to call her regularly, and they talk for about 10 minutes each time. She says she mostly tries to comfort him.
Sometimes the conversation is really difficult. If he's sick, he will describe his symptoms to me, and he will mention about his frustrations, his depression.
Chu says Wang's health is deteriorating. He has painful arthritis in both of his knees.
He's so anxious about his situation. He's so anxious about coming home. But there is very little progress.
Chu was afraid she would hurt her husband's chances of release if she spoke publicly about his detention. So for more than a year, she kept quiet. But in July, Iran went public. The judiciary announced Wang had been sentenced to 10 years in prison for espionage. The verdict was upheld on appeal in August. Chu says she now feels it's important to speak out so people know her husband is more than a political pawn.
My husband as a student, as a scholar, and as a husband and a father, this is totally a political situation. It's nothing about my husband's activities in Tehran, I mean for his research.
At a vigil at Princeton, friends and colleagues told stories about Wang, about how he's a language nerd. He speaks 9 languages, including Hindi, Urdu, Russian, Farsi. He even worked one summer translating Pashto for the Red Cross in Afghanistan. When Wang left for Iran, his son was 2. Chu says their son used to point at planes and helicopters and say his dad was in them, coming home. But he doesn't do that anymore. One time, when Wang called, Chu gave the phone to her son.
And he just directly said, why is it doesn't come back? When are you coming back? It's just challenge him why you're not here with us. So it's really heartbreaking for my husband.
Chu says she even struggles to picture him in her head now.
Yes, and my husband, he described to me that he looks old and there are many wrinkles on his face and many gray hairs. His back is not straight anymore and he cannot walk properly. So I don't know how does he, when I put together what he described to himself into a minute, I don't think his dad is my husband.
She says she's in regular contact with the State Department, which has called for his release. And she follows the news closely, especially coverage of the Iran nuclear deal. It worries her.
The Iran-U.S. relationship is getting worse and worse. And he is detained because of his American citizen.
Wang is a naturalized American, but he was born in China. Chu hopes the Iranian government will take into account the friendship between China and Iran. But she says Chinese officials have told her they can't help him in any official capacity because Wang is no longer a Chinese citizen.
I hope the U.S. government can do everything they can to secure his release. And I hope the Iranian government can let him come home to be a father and to be a husband. It has been very devastating for us and hope this ordeal can end very soon.
For The World, I'm Ibi Caputo.
Just ahead, the lessons of Vietnam and of another documentary about the war. You're with The World.
I Like Words.
A podcast.
Elegant, flowery words.
About language.
Tonsorial.
The world in words.
Grapple. Jostle.
The world in words.
Crunchy, crackly words.
Get it on Apple Podcasts.
Or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. Should the U.S. have intervened in Vietnam? Yep, that question again. But it's out there because another documentary is asking it. I'm talking about the 10-part series produced by Ken Burns and Lynn Novick, which started last week on PBS and continues through this Thursday. The narrator in the doc tells us the Vietnam War was begun in good faith by decent people.
it echoes the comment that was made in Graham Greene's The Quiet American, where he said, "I never knew a man who had better motives for all the trouble he caused."
That's reporter Mary Kay Magstad. She's a longtime correspondent in Southeast Asia and visited Vietnam a lot in the 1980s and 90s. She's also been watching the PBS series, and it's given her a lot to think about again. Magstad says Americans' deep misunderstanding about the U.S. role in Vietnam eclipsed any good intentions they might have had.
You sort of see that at play within the documentary series, that, you know, you have Americans going in, risking their lives, sometimes giving their lives, and they truly believe that they're doing it on the side of right. And I say this, you know, with sympathy, because, you know, I had an uncle who went into the Vietnam War, who enlisted and was there in 68, right on the DMZ, you know, actually took a bullet in his canteen, thought he had been hit and wasn't going to come back. But it turned out that the bullet lodged on the inner wall of the canteen. So what he was feeling running down his side was water. He did come back. That, in fact, is part of what got me interested in being a foreign correspondent. I was obsessed with Vietnam when I was in high school and college. I read as much as I could about it, and I talked to him, and I was really interested in, well, what is this place like when there's not a war? I mean, these are three-dimensional people who have their own values and goals and understandings of how the world should work. And what came across to me when I was talking to my uncle over time was that he had real respect both for the Vietnamese for whom he was an advisor there, but also for those who were fighting on the other side. I respect the fact that in this documentary series, Burns and Novick make a point of saying that the American soldiers who were there respected the fighting ability and the discipline and the dedication of the Northern Vietnamese troops, even as they hated them and were trying to kill them. And that the Northern Vietnamese, when they talk about their experience in the war, talk about how sympathy and hatred were entwined. You know, they wanted to get rid of these invaders, but they would see Americans crying over their dead and pulling the injured off the battlefield. And they said, so they cared about their own too, like us. I think with this documentary series, I greatly respect the fact that it's allowing different people from different sides to recall what this experience was like for them. There's also this odd device within the script at times where they talk about the enemy.
I was going to ask you about that. It pops up surprisingly frequently. What do you make of that use of the word?
I'm puzzled by it because, you know, at the time for the troops who were on the field, these were the enemy. But now as we're talking about this half a century later, they're Vietnamese. And in fact, Vietnam and the United States get along pretty well these days, both at a policy level and also very much on a personal level. There was just a Pew survey of Asian attitudes toward the United States and China, and Vietnamese had the strongest positive rating in terms of their feelings toward the United States of any Asian population.
Wow.
You know, so there's a great deal of capability for forgiveness in Vietnam. I often have found as a foreign correspondent covering China, living in China for a long time as the world's correspondent, that as a mental exercise, if you flip the situation and think, what would Americans do in a situation like this? If America was invaded by a foreign power that was bombing Iowa and Montana and, you know, Colorado, how would Americans react and how hard would they fight?
Yeah, that's an important perspective for sure. So the series continues through this week, Mary Kay. What is the story about Vietnam that, in your opinion, still needs to be told at some point, that most documentarians still have yet to latch onto?
I think it would be really interesting if a Vietnamese filmmaker put together a non-ideological, non-partisan documentary, which would necessarily still be a different compilation than what we're seeing with Ken Burns and Lynn Novick doing it this time. You know, even while they're trying to be even-handed and give different people a voice, there's still a little bit of a slant. There's still a little bit of a inability to step back far enough. Maybe we also need to hear more from the side that lost not 58,000 people, but 3 million people in this war. And I think one thing that we as Americans could internalize better when it comes to getting engaged in wars, going to other people's countries and fighting is, you know, to think about, you know, what price people are paying for the decisions we're making about what's important to those people. People don't like having their countries invaded. And so when you're going to be generally, and so when you're going to be going in, unless it's something like, you know, liberating France from the Nazis in World War II, you have to be clear about, you know, why are you going in, and do you understand what people on the ground, what the population of the country you're going into want, and what they're willing to accept in terms of a foreign power changing the dynamics in their own country.
Mary Kay, thanks very much for your thoughts. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, Marco.
Correspondent Mary Kay Magstad there. She visited Vietnam regularly in the 1980s and 90s and is now the host of the podcast, Whose Century Is It? Okay, now to the heated debate that dominated this past weekend, whether the Take a Knee protest during the national anthem, started by Colin Kaepernick, is acceptable or not. President Trump says no, many others say yes. And that sparked discussion all over the world. Here's how one of my BBC colleagues, Will Yates, explained Take a Knee to his international audience.
This whole affair is quite a potent symbol of how divided the US actually is. On one side of the argument, you have the Kaepernick supporters, who are mostly liberal and anti-Trump. And for them, he's a hero, a kind of figurehead for peaceful protest. And on the other, directly opposed to that view, you have the more right-wing traditionalists, and they see his actions as being deeply disrespectful to the anthem, to the flag, and by extension to the US military. And this is all being played out against the background of America's favorite sport, American football.
It's not the first time discussions about patriotism and racism here in the U.S. have been thrust onto the world sporting stage. Perhaps the most iconic of those moments came during the 1968 Summer Olympic Games in Mexico.
On the outside, it's Edwin Roberts. It's John Carlos right now. It's Carlos and Smith. And here comes Tommy Smith!
American sprinters Tommy Smith and John Carlos were set to receive the gold and bronze medals after the 200-meter men's event. On their way up to the podium, they took off their shoes to protest poverty. They wore beaded necklaces and scarves around their necks to protest the lynchings of black Americans. And when the national anthem came on, they lowered their heads and raised their fists covered in black gloves. For the duration of the anthem, their fists stayed in the air.
Tommy Smith and John Carlos had been suspended by the United States Olympic Committee and given 48 hours to leave Mexico.
Years later, when John Carlos was asked if he ever regretted his move, he said, "I have no regrets. The people who have regrets are the ones who were there in 1968 and did nothing."
What would the news sound like if media were diverse?
Things get racialized here. Muslim is this weird racial thing here, and I don't think our parents were prepared for that.
I'm Rupa Shenoy, host of the podcast Otherhood. Listen to What You're Missing on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Marco Werman. Iraqi Kurds voted today in a referendum on independence. This man chose to abstain.
I'll not say yes because I think they pretend democracy, but they are more like dictators. And I'll neither say no because someday I might regret it.
Doubts about an independent Kurdistan, that's still ahead on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Angela Merkel is still in charge. Yesterday, she won a fourth consecutive term as Chancellor of Germany. That outcome was not a surprise, but here's something that did come as a bit of a shock. For the first time in decades, a far-right party won seats in the German parliament. The party is called the AfD, the acronym for Alternative for Germany. And their platform? Germany has too many foreigners, they say, and not enough pride in its World War II veterans. Elizabeth Whaling researches political language at UC Berkeley. She grew up in Germany and is currently in Berlin to study the election. So what did you notice about the rhetoric in the German campaign and the election?
A lot of the linguistic phrases, a lot of the imagery, a lot of the claims that the AfD put out there was adapted by other parties and even the media. So we had endless discussion rounds, you know, whether it be on radio or TV, talking about the so-called refugee flood, the so-called refugee tsunami, etc. So what happened is that really in many, many instances, not just the AfD was promoting its own ideas and worldview, but the rest of the political spectrum and the media bought into that language. There are certain words that you know you simply cannot use, but there are ways to truly frame refugees and migrants as a threat to the German national identity without using hate speech. Think about it for just a moment. If you talk about incoming refugees and you label them a flood, a stream of water, a tsunami, you really do bring up these very intense images in people's minds and create a notion of threat and a notion of immediate danger to the German nation.
Yeah, and of course, it's also really interesting how that kind of language on the campaign trail lands with voters. Let's listen to one. Here's Hartwig, a voter, speaking after he cast his vote for AfD in Berlin.
Wir wollen alle Angie, alle die Merkel abwählen.
We want to vote Angie, or Frau Merkel, out of office. The AfD has reasonable perspectives on stopping foreigners from entering our country. At some point, there just won't be enough space for everybody. I'm no racist, but we as Germans would be forced out of our own country because people who can't get it together are governing us.
Is this pretty typical of a far-right supporter, Elizabeth?
Very typical, yeah. I mean, this is exactly the language and the images that they have been using throughout the campaign, and that is the language that then the voters and the supporters of the AfD pick up.
How did the language in the German election compare with what you've seen and heard in the U.S. in 2016?
Actually, there have been a lot of similarities. If you look at the language that has been used, especially by the AfD, but also by some other groups like Die Linke, which is the left-wing populist party, there has been a lot of talk of gaining back national autonomy, of national autonomy being threatened, whether it be by the West in general, whether it be by refugees, whether it be by the European Union. So that whole notion of taking back control, which also has been a slogan of those who were voting for the Brexit in the UK, that whole notion was a very strong part of the campaigns that were going on and are very similar to the things that Donald Trump, for instance, has been using in his campaign and still is using.
You've mentioned the future a couple of times. I mean, how extreme do you think this new direction in Germany will swing? I'm seeing people today seeing right-wingers in the Bundestag, not since World War II.
Yeah, no, it's insane. You know, and a lot of Germans have a very hard time wrapping their heads around what's happening here. I do believe that we have a good chance that once the party is in parliament and once the lack of platform, the lack of policy, the lack of ability to really change political things in the country long term, I think that might, you know, impact voters. However, they have been very, very successful in propagating nationalistic authoritarian values and ideology, and that I do not think is gonna just go away anytime soon, because one thing that we know about the brain and language and political discourse is that if you tell people something over and over and over again, it truly becomes part of their neural infrastructure. It becomes part of the physicality of their brain. And so that is not just going anywhere overnight.
UC Berkeley's Elizabeth Whaling there speaking with us from Berlin. We have more on the AfD in our latest World in Words podcast, where we ask the question, why is Germany's new right recycling words first popularized by the Nazis? Check it out at pri.org/language or wherever you get your podcasts. So as we heard, one of the big questions that divided German voters was what will happen to the more than 1 million refugees living in the country. Ahmad Wali Timari is one of those refugees. His journey took him from Afghanistan to an office inside the German parliament. He spoke with the world's Daniel Gross.
Ahmad Wali Timari worked in Afghanistan as an interpreter for the U.S. Army, an incredibly dangerous job. He says the Taliban made multiple attempts on his life. He applied for a U.S. visa, but his application was rejected. So he decided to leave Afghanistan for a country that welcomed refugees, Germany. His family didn't want him to go.
That was very difficult for me. You know, I never forget this night. My mother was, well, she was crying and she told me it's not possible, to Germany without visa. Yes, maybe you can die there and like, don't go, please stay here. And I said, I know this, all of these things, but I have to leave.
Temeri hired a smuggler and joined other refugees on a journey that took months. From Afghanistan, they crossed Pakistan and then Iran. One day, he says, they hiked 15 hours through the snow. One companion slipped and didn't get up.
I said, stand up. What's happening? He didn't give me answer. I said, stand up, please. What's happened?
Temeri knew CPR from his time with the U.S. Army, but it didn't help. The man died, probably of heart failure. The smuggler told them to keep going.
I was crying, just crying, and I was praying for them and also for us.
In Turkey and Greece, he spent weeks in jail. In Hungary, he finally climbed into the back of a truck that took him to Germany. He applied for asylum in August 2015, and this time, he got it.
And I have to start my life from zero. Everybody, every refugee, they have to start a life from zero.
Temeri comes from a political family in Afghanistan. So in Berlin, he started going to law classes. He took German, too. As we talk about that first year, we switch into German. One night, he says he was browsing Facebook.
Ja, ich habe auf Facebook das also nur einfach also die Nachricht gesehen und so.
He saw a post about refugees by Birgitte Zupries, a politician from the Social Democratic Party. He decided to send her a message and ask for an internship.
Also kein Problem, ich versuche. Wenn das geklappt.
He thought, I'll just try it. If it doesn't work, no problem. She responded the very next morning. He worked in her office for 6 months. Zupries is now a minister in Angela Merkel's cabinet. Today, Temeri considers Germany a second home. He hopes to get a bachelor's degree and work in the Bundestag one day, maybe even as a member of parliament.
Ich bin auch sehr dankbar für Bundesrepublik Deutschland.
He says he's grateful to Germany and to Angela Merkel. I've met her a couple times, he says. She's a strong woman and very nice. I asked Temeri whether refugees still feel welcome in Germany. It's complicated, he says. Some Afghan refugees have been deported. Merkel's party, the CDU, officially says Afghan immigrants don't need protection. Afghanistan is not a safe place, Temeri says. His family in Afghanistan now live under Taliban rule. So this past weekend, Temeri organized a protest against deportations outside the foreign ministry. He hopes Angela Merkel hears about it. Temeri is concerned that the far-right AfD won seats in parliament. He thinks it's bad news for Europe. But he's optimistic about the future.
Das ist okay, dass wir kommen von verschiedenen Land und wir sprechen verschiedene Sprachen.
We come from different countries, he says. We speak different languages and have different cultures. But we have one thing in common. We're all people, and we have to help each other. For the World, Daniel Gross, Berlin.
Here's another vote we're watching closely. Millions of Kurds in northern Iraq also went to the polls today, not to vote for a leader, but on whether they should be their own independent nation. It is a historic moment, but also not without controversy. The World's Richard Hall is in the capital, Erbil. What's the day been like there, Rich? Why is this such a momentous occasion?
It's been quite a remarkable day here, actually. It's rare that you get to report on something so hopeful in the Middle East. I went out to the polling stations this morning and spoke to some of the voters, and people are just very, very happy that this thing that they've been waiting for so long is finally happening. The Kurds have been fighting for independence for their own country for around 100 years now. I actually spoke to one guy, Mahmoud, who was outside of the polling station with his pregnant wife. He was very emotional.
In this morning, when the sun raised, I cried. It's been a long, long time that we are waiting for this day. And if it's happening during me, that means I am the history. And I want to tell this to my son when it's coming.
Wow, Rich, he really sees his vote as historic and symbolic. The U.S., however, and the EU, Turkey, and Iraq all strongly oppose this referendum. Can you help us understand why?
Yes, each for different reasons, actually. So the U.S. is concerned with the fight against ISIS. They say that this could weaken Iraq and all the forces fighting against ISIS at a time when ISIS still hasn't been defeated. Turkey, for a slightly different reason, they have a very large Kurdish population in the southeast who have aspirations of their own for statehood and for autonomy, and they're worried that this will create a knock-on effect in their own country. And Iraq, because it doesn't want the breakup of its own country, Baghdad wants to keep Iraq together. That's why they oppose it.
All right, so lots of concern about destabilizing the region if this referendum passes. Little surprise that the Kurds are overwhelmingly supportive of the independence referendum, but you discovered something kind of interesting as you were reporting this.
That's right. Yeah, like you say, most people here are very supportive of independence. What I found when I was reporting here was that there are some younger voters who feel left out of this whole process. They have a slightly different set of priorities.
All right, Rich, let's hear what you found.
Iraqi Kurdistan is in the midst of referendum fever. Kurdish flags fly on almost every building. It's the only topic of conversation in the coffee shops and around the dinner table. That sound you can hear is 100,000 people packed inside a stadium for a rally on Friday. There's little doubt that the Yes side will win a sweeping victory today. But hidden amid all the flag-waving fervour, there is something of an enthusiasm gap between the young and the old.
I will boycott it.
That's 28-year-old Rinas Khalid. He definitely does not have referendum fever.
I'll not say yes, because I think they pretend democracy, but they are more than like dictators. And I'll neither say no, because someday I might regret it.
And he's not alone. Sangar Rasool, a political researcher, thinks that now is not the right time. There is so much other work to do first, he says.
I want a very good democratic process in my country. I want to see a clear election. I want to see a very powerful judiciary system instead of see a very powerful militia. That's our problems. We should first tackle these problems. It's a very serious problem.
Khalid and Rasool are examples of what I'll call the reluctant millennial voter in this campaign. They want Kurdistan to be independent. Almost everyone here does. But they think Iraqi Kurdistan needs to get its own shop in order first. Khalid studied for years to be an engineer. Now he works as a translator because the economy is in such poor shape. There are many young people like him in Kurdistan. I wander through the centuries-old Kayseri Bazaar in the centre of Erbil to find a charming little tea house. Inside there are old men in the traditional baggy Kurdish clothes. And in the corner, a group of young men in jeans and t-shirts huddle around their smartphones. The contrast is stark. 23-year-old Soran Salah is in favour of independence, but he shares the frustrations of many young people here in Kurdistan.
Like, for example, my education is engineering, and I work for a communication company. That's not my field. I have a friend who worked with me, same engineer. I have another friend, he's a doctor. He works with his father in contracts, building contracts. So that's the reason, like, there is no jobs right now.
Young people here feel they are ignored by their aging rulers. President Masoud Barzani, a former guerrilla leader, is 71 years old. His term expired 2 years ago, but he is justified staying on by saying he must first defeat ISIS. Behind Saleh, the walls of the tea shop are filled with grainy pictures of old Kurdish revolutionaries and leaders, Barzani among them. It's very fitting. This referendum has been as much about the past as it has the future. This is one of the many ads that ran during the campaign urging people to vote yes. It shows an old man, a teacher, in front of a classroom of students. He recounts the suffering of Kurds under successive Iraqi governments, including the brutal killing of some 50,000 by Saddam Hussein's army. Graphic images of these massacres flash across the screen. First, let's build our state, and then we can solve our internal issues, the old man says. Ads like this one are very evocative and seem to be working. Even those young people who are not enthusiastic about the future here can understand the great pain Kurds have experienced in the past. It's part of their identity. This is what 22-year-old Avin Majidnada told me. I meet her at the top of Erbil's ancient citadel.
We will say yes, inshallah. Those people that will say no, I don't know why they do that. And everybody, you want to be free. We hear the stories before. So we have to be good for our country, and we have to vote. We have to vote for our rights. That's why I will say yes.
For the world, Richard Hall in Erbil, northern Iraq.
At PRI.org, Rich has posted some great pictures of young Kurdish voters. President Trump didn't let his travel ban expire yesterday. Instead, he beefed it up. and made it open-ended. Travel ban 3.0, as some are calling it, bars entry from six Muslim-majority countries, plus Venezuela and North Korea. In the case of Venezuela, only government officials are affected. As for North Korea, it's hard to imagine a ban really having much effect, given how few North Koreans even try to make their way to the U.S. So this ban seems primarily focused on folks from Chad, Iran, Libya, Somalia, Syria, and Yemen. They feel singled out, as you can imagine, and Muslim Americans from those countries especially so. Dr. Debbie Almentasser is on the board of the Yemeni American Merchants Association. So it kind of seems like Venezuela and North Korea are distractions with this ban. But just to gauge your reaction to it, Debbie, let me read you this quote from Anthony Romero of the American Civil Liberties Union. He says, President Trump's original sin of targeting Muslims cannot be cured by throwing other countries onto his enemies list. What is your take on that?
I definitely agree with him. I think what President Trump right now has done is try to whitewash the Muslim ban by adding countries that are not Muslim majority countries. And it's really unfortunate because no matter how you coin the Muslim ban or the AKA travel ban, which he calls it, it is still looks like a Muslim ban.
Now, Sudan had been on the first list, but it's been lifted from this list. And there were some people who came to the U.S. from Sudan who had special status that protected them from being deported, temporary protective status, TPS. That ended just last week. Suddenly, Sudan is no longer part of the travel ban. What was going on there?
I asked the same question. Why was Sudan taken off? I'm very happy that it did. And I think that each and every one of the countries who have been put on this ban need to be removed.
So would you urge Sudanese to still be vigilant that they could possibly be rounded up and deported? What would be your advice?
My advice to Sudanese and people from, you know, different parts of the Muslim world, the Arab world, and Africa to be vigilant, because we just don't know what this administration is capable of doing. And we have to be vigilant and we have to work to save, you know, the soul of our democracy.
So, Dr. Almentasser, you're Yemeni-American, and once again, travel from Yemen is banned. We should remember that Yemen is a country where the U.S. is helping prolong a civil war that might be causing people to try to flee, maybe even to the U.S. So, given the U.S. role in Yemen right now, what are you hearing from Yemenis today?
You know, even though that Yemen is a part of the allied forces in the civil war with Saudi Arabia, you know, in Yemen, regardless, Yemenis both in the United States and Yemenis seeking to flee Yemen still see America as a viable place to flee to. And we have thousands of family members that are actually stranded in Djibouti, in Jordan, in Egypt, in Malaysia, simply waiting for their visa processing to actually join their American citizen family members. And because of the Muslim ban, it has now prolonged this process. And so for an example, my brother-in-law, who has been for the last 2 years trying to bring his wife, and because of all of the vetting process that has been going on, they kept asking him for, you know, materials, documentation after documentation. And just when we thought she was going to get an appointment for the interview, the Muslim ban came into effect, and then that delayed the process. We are now, you know, happy to say that she does have an appointment on September 29, but we don't even know what that means now with the latest ban.
Dr. Debbie Almentasser, on the board of the Yemeni American Merchants Association, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
We've tackled a lot of heavy topics on the show today. So tell you what, let's finish with Balkan mariachi. Yeah, you heard me right. Turns out that Mexican mariachi music caught on big time in Cold War Yugoslavia. My BBC colleague Pablo Esperza went to Belgrade to find out why.
Mexican cinema was very famous and very popular in Yugoslavia, and there were local bands imitating those songs played in Mexican movies. So it was a homegrown style.
That's wild. So Mexican mariachi music, Mexican movies. Why did this Mexican culture become so popular in the former Yugoslavia?
To know that origin, we have to look into the Cold War. After the Second World War, Yugoslavia became a socialist country, but they broke relations with the USSR. So they stopped importing films and music from the USSR. Mm. So they had to look somewhere else, and they couldn't go to Hollywood or to the West because they were a socialist country. So they found that alternative in Mexico. It was like a third way, to say so, not from Hollywood, not from the Soviets. So it was kind of in the middle.
Is there some cultural affinity between the two cultures that makes this kind of a natural fit? Like, you know, Balkan and Mexican cultures, what do they have in common?
To be honest, Slavko Perovic, this famous Mexican song singer of the time, who now is 83, he told me that actually Serbians and Mexicans have something in common, which is that they are very temperamental. He said to me, when we laugh, we laugh. When we cry, we cry. We do it in a true way. So probably that openness is something that links the culture with the Latin culture of Mexico.
So you met Slavko Perovic, one of the stars of that scene in the former Yugoslavia. How did he go about learning these songs?
Well, according to what he told me, he went to movies. He liked the songs that were played in those movies. And he started bringing his own recorder to the film theater and registering all the songs. Then back home, he started transcribing the sounds because he didn't speak Spanish at all, and he doesn't speak Spanish now either. So he started to imitate the sounds of the music and the sounds of the lyrics.
Do you have a personal favorite song after going to Belgrade and kind of digging into this mariachi culture there?
There's one that I liked very much because it's a very popular traditional Mexican tune, Las Mañanitas, which in English would be like Little Mornings, something like that, that is sung for birthdays and name days. And in Serbo-Croatian, they adapted it to their own taste, but they started using it in a very different context as well. Instead of using it for birthdays or for name days, they started using it to pay tribute to their mothers.
Our friend at the BBC, Pablo Esperza, helping us keep the little-known cult sound of Balkan mariachi alive. Thank you very much, Pablo. Good to speak.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, like I always say, nothing that a little Balkan mariachi can't solve. From the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We'll be back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.